Most people go to the same old job every day, doing the same things every day, barely getting by. But it doesn't have to be that way. This is the real path to BYOB. Be your own boss. Change your life through real estate. On this show, we'll have interviews and inspiration from people who've made it, bringing you real life stories to help you chart your own path to BYOB. This is the real path to BYOB. Be your own boss. And now, here's your host, Mun Sachapuri.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Real Path to BYOB, the show that aims to inspire you to achieve financial freedom and be your own boss. I'm your host, Mansa Chapuri, and our guest for today is Param Baladandapani. She is a subspecialty trained radiologist who, while working full-time and raising two young kids, built a multi-million dollar real estate portfolio that helped her become financially independent and retire at 41. She's the founder and CEO of Generational Wealth MD, a community that helps high-income professionals accelerate towards financial freedom by building a real estate portfolio that fits their lifestyle and goals. Over the last 8 years, she has invested in long-term and short-term rentals, as well as developmental projects in different domestic markets and abroad. She brings this expertise to Emerge small group coaching program, creating generational freedom, where she empowers others to start and scale their portfolios. And she's also very passionate about paying it forward and has helped establish a nonprofit educational trust in rural India. Wow, so much in the bio there. Welcome to the show, Param. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Manasa. I'm so happy to be here.
So you are originally a radiologist, and while working a full-time job, you learned about real estate and started building your portfolio. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually started, so 2010 was when I finished my training and I became an attending, and started making real money, essentially. And I had a mentor in my first job, and he was a real estate investor. He was a third generation real estate investor. And he introduced me to the stock market and real estate. And he mentored me, essentially introduced me to teams and helped me start, get started with real estate investing. So I got my first long-term rental 2014. And then I wasn't really understanding things properly. So I was looking at my cash flow and I didn't think it was going to replace my clinical income anytime soon. So I just, I wasn't really paying attention to it. And 2018, I got another property. And 2019 was pivotal for me because there was a merger at work and I was like, okay, wait, I don't want to be totally dependent on my clinical income. What's my portfolio doing? So I looked at my portfolio, I looked at the stock part of it. I looked at real estate. And so by that time, I built up equity in those properties, just because of holding it, market appreciation, debt pay down. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at it, I realized that with a third of my money invested in real estate compared to the stock market, I was generating twice as much in terms of passive income, right? Not just the cash flow, but and I didn't have tax savings at that point because I wasn't an active investor. But with the equity increase over time and the cash flow together, and so that's when I was like, for me, that was the moment I was like, okay, if I want to do this fast, and my kids were at that time, they were like one and four at that point. And I was like, I don't want to wait. And then I put it into a calculator and I said, if I had to do this with the stock market with index funds, it would take me another 15 years to get to financial independence. I was like, okay, I don't want to do that because my kids will be out of the house by then. Yeah. So it just didn't make sense. So the only way to really boost those returns and get to financial independence faster was real estate. And that's when I started pouring my energy into educating myself and scaling rapidly and using tax strategies and sheltering my clinical income, recycling the money, all of that. And then I thought it would take me at least three years to get to that point. But 12 months later, I figured I'd hit my financial independence numbers. And that's when there was another point, it was a pandemic, all of us were struggling. I was fortunately able to work from home a little bit, even as a radiologist. I was working from home 2 days and managing my kids. My son was doing online learning. My daughter couldn't go to preschool. And it was crazy. And then I was like, okay, wait, I can now scale back. I can take control of things. And so I decided to go down to, so I work 3 days a month now. Because I still, you know, I love being a radiologist. I love what I do. I work with women and breast cancer screening. So we're creating a world with more birthdays is the slogan. So I want to do that. I do that 3 days a month. And that works for me right now because my kids are really little and they're still home. And the rest of the time I get to do what I want to do.
Awesome. I love, 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 love your story. I think the things that resonate with me are twofold. So as you might have seen, right, with women, whenever we have like these high paying careers, there's so much demand on time that comes with it. And when you want to start a family, is that there's additional pressure of like being able to spend time with your family versus your career. So I think like you are the perfect example of like a woman going out and creating that freedom so that she can decide where you want to spend your time, because you still are passionate about your work, but your kids are equally important and you have that freedom to be able to do what you want now. So it's such that I think that really resonates with a lot of women out there in tech, in your space, in the medical industry. So on that note, so you chose real estate. Why not the stock markets? You said real estate was much quicker.
Yeah. So that's when I learned about the 4% safe withdrawal rate, which means like you need a portfolio of $2.5 million in your stock portfolio for you to be able to withdraw $100,000 from it annually for your expenses and live off of it for 30 to 40 years. So they've done multiple studies about this, Bengen study, Trinity study. But basically when I realized that, and my portfolio at that point was close to $500,000 in stocks, right? And I was like, so to get to that point, there are calculators. You plug your numbers in and you say, I'm saving this much every month. And this is what, you know, the stock market returns during growth. So how do I get to the point where I can then withdraw 4% from it and live off of it? And that was like $2.5 million. And so I was like, okay, to get to that point, I could skimp and save. It would still take me at least 10 years. And I didn't want to do that. But with real estate, you have the ability to boost your returns using multiple strategies and to recycle your money because of many things, because you're using leverage, because you can use other people's money, because the tax code is structured in a way to give real estate investors those benefits because you're essentially stimulating the economy, right? When you tap into all those things and then your returns, you can modify that by forcing appreciation when you're doing a rehab, and so, which is what you do even in multifamily, right? You go in and you value add and you're able to increase your returns. So because you're boosting your returns and you're significantly getting to that point faster, and then during withdrawal, like with real estate, the money's tax-free, right? Your cash flow is tax-free. And that doesn't drop to like a 4% withdrawal when you're in retirement. You're still getting the same returns, the same high returns. Mm-hmm. So it was a no-brainer. It's like, okay, 10 to 15 years in the stock market, or like, you know, depending on how fast you do it, 1 to 3 years in real estate. And it was a no-brainer. But just coming back to what you were saying, Manasa, it's so true. Women, I think most professionals, right? Like even men, there's a lot of burnout you face when you're trying to juggle work and, you know, those non-flexible schedules and managing the kids. You can ask for things. I asked to go down to 0.6. I was like, I don't need to make as much as I'm making. I'm willing to work 3 days a week. Will you work with me? Because I think that'll give me better work-life balance. And they weren't in a position to give me that. But when I got to the point that I was financially independent, I could take my turns to them and say, hey, I can work a day a week and that'll work for me. But if not, I don't think I can do more than that. And then you just have more negotiating power, right? Everything turns. So I feel like for most of us, financial independence is not just about the money. It's about so much more.
Right. So true. So true. So when you started out in real estate, you mentioned your properties had already appreciated and you leveraged that. So in taking that money and like, you know, diversifying into other assets, like you said, your mentorship came into play. What knowledge did you need at that point?
Yeah. So my original mentor, right? So the colleague that I worked with 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I initially, what he did for me, which was great, was he condensed my timelines, right? He introduced me to the right markets. He helped me understand things and he introduced me to the right teams in those markets. Because I think that really hastens the process, because a lot of people get stuck in, okay, which market do I pick? Who do I reach out to? Who's going to help me do this in a way that it's mailbox money, that so that I'm not putting more time into managing these properties? So he really helped me with that, right? And I'm eternally grateful to him for it. And that was his strategy. But he wasn't really using leverage or the tax savings and other enforcing appreciation. He wasn't doing a lot of that. So when I started putting all those other things into play, and that I did with education on the side, I took tax courses and I took asset protection courses, other things on the side. When I put those into play, I felt like I was able to further condense my timelines. And so what he was able to do in 12 years, I was able to do in 12 months when I was able to add those other strategies on there. So mentorship does so many things, right? It helps you boost your returns. It helps you condense those timelines. Right. It introduces you to the right teams where you're not working like crazy managing this thing. You have a team that's going to do that for you. So like a bunch of different things and giving you all that knowledge up front, which helps you strategize things the right way. Right. I think those are like, so basically this is what I coach and I mentor people in real estate. And this is what I say, I took 10 years to do this. And looking back, I could have done it in less than 2 years. Mm-hmm. I could have become financially independent before I even had my son. You know, I didn't have to go through those short maternity leaves. That's what coaching and mentorship does. It introduces you to the right teams. It condenses those timelines. So you're able to get from point A to point B that much faster, essentially.
Yeah, totally agree with that. So when you mention teams, are you referring to the people like who are boots on the ground, the realtors, the property managers, the contractors?
Yes. Because my first few properties were all out of state. And that's how I started. I lived in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I wasn't sure if I was going to live there long term. So I decided to invest out of state. And a lot of people think of out of state investing and it seems scary. They want to buy something closer, sure. Right? I just want to be able to see it and have more control over it. But this is where my mentor helped me because we lived in New York at the time and his entire portfolio was in Tennessee. Right. And so I saw, and he was very, very comfortable with that because he had a great team, like a great agent and a property manager on the ground. And so when I saw that, I realized that it was totally doable. And that's where, the magic of the team works because you don't really need to be there as long as you have trusted people on the ground who can do it really well. And if they come with great references, then you can totally rely on them. So, and this is what I say right now. And over time, I have enlarged my local portfolio just because being active in that portfolio gives me all the tax savings, right? Mm-hmm. So I do local rehabs. I do it without a general contractor. That's my local portfolio. Mm-hmm. But I still prefer my out-of-state portfolio because I'm forced to have those systems in place where everything is automated and optimized. So the amount of time I spend on my out-of-state portfolio to this day ends up being less than 2 hours a month, if you average accounting and, setting up the LLCs and everything, which is great. With my local portfolios, I find that I get pulled in a little more because it's possible for me to go and be more hands-on. Yeah. But that works for me right now just because I want to have that. I want to have the, be a little more active and get those tax savings. I'm able to shelter my clinical income because of that. But your teams, especially if you're an out-of-state investor, that's where you're building that system where you're leveraging your teams and you're not the one spending all your time on the portfolio.
Got it. Yeah, that sounds amazing. I think because the goal is for most folks, at least if you have a high paying job, is to create that passive income, right? So the point you bring up with the teams is super critical to make that happen. And you mentioned like it's to the mentorship that you got connected, like, or did you have to like go explore like network in the sense and, meet these people one-on-one? Did you have to do that or were these connections referred to you by someone?
So I think people do it very differently, right, Manasa? So some people are part of a local real estate investor association group, and that's how they do it, and they network. I would say I'm lucky and fortunate because I was introduced to some teams by my original mentor. I was introduced to another team by a family friend who along with his friends, had used these teams for a while. So all of them came with references, but I totally see that for many people that may not be an option, and which is why I say, if you are interested in doing it locally, that's fine. You can build your teams and you can ask for references. But if you're an out-of-state investor, make sure you have at least two connections over there with teams that people that you trust have used for multiple years, and that's going to help you.
Okay. That's great advice. Yeah. For someone venturing into like a low cost market, but on the cash flow, I think that's really great advice. Thank you for sharing that. I want to switch topics a little bit here. So you are experienced with long-term and short-term investing, right?
Short-term
rentals.
Yes.
So I've never had a guest speak about short-term rentals before. Okay. Yeah. So I want to deep dive more into that area with you. Could you like give us, let's get started by like defining what short-term rental is and how is it different from long-term?
Absolutely. So short-term rentals are like all the rage these days, especially since the pandemic, especially among high-income professionals, because it gives you this unique opportunity while working full-time to be able to take those tax savings and use it to shelter your clinical income, which is why I think more people are doing it. But a short-term rental, essentially, and the way the tax code defines this, there are two different ways of defining it. The one that's most commonly used is if you have a property and the average stay per customer over the course of that calendar year is 7 days or less, then that's considered a short-term rental. And so there's another definition, but just not make it complex. We'll just stick with this for now. So that's your typical Airbnb, the VRBO properties. So as long as you meet this criteria, then that's considered a short-term rental by the tax code.
Okay. So when you are trying to add that to your portfolio, let's say for a novice investor just starting out, doesn't have a big portfolio, doesn't have all these LLCs and businesses set up, can they buy that as their secondary home?
Yeah, and that's a great question, Manasa, because there are multiple advantages to buying it as a second home, right? You're able to get owner-occupied financing, which means you can put 10% down as opposed to putting 25% down for an investment property. You're able to get owner-occupied to lower interest rates because it's a second home, right? So all of those things make it very simple. And the lending, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, they come up with the rules for how you can, whether you can classify something as a second home. And they changed those rules like 2 or 3 years ago, where they say that as long as you're staying in the property for, I believe it's 14 days during that calendar year, and you're occupying it for some part of the year, it is okay for you to rent it out as a short-term rental for the rest of that year. So all those mortgage rules, if you purchase it as a second home, typically only apply to the first year, right? So it's how you treat the property the first year. Mm-hmm. So the rules have now been modified to the point where even in the first year, as long as you use the property for 14 days, you can use it as a short-term rental for the rest of the time. That's different because you're not establishing a landlord-tenant relationship like you would if it were a long-term rental, or if it was something where you had someone stay there for 6 months. Because you aren't doing that, it's okay for you to use that property. Legally, it's okay for you to use that property as a second home and get those terms for your financing. So yeah, it's absolutely possible. And there are a lot of lenders who work with that.
Wow, that is such an amazing advantage. Yeah, looks like a really niche area, because for for all investments, you typically need 25%. And I think and the rates are much higher too. I don't know how the rates are for a secondary home. Probably slightly higher.
But I think it's probably like 0.25% higher than a primary home, but not like 0.5 or 0.75% higher like you would have with an investment property.
Got it. Great to know. Yeah, seriously, that's some really great information right there. So let's talk about the other aspects. How about the property management aspect and like the secure? Let's talk one thing then. Property management. How do you handle that part?
Yeah. Like I was saying, the advantages of entering the short-term rental space are that you typically have higher cash flow, right? With a long-term rental in these markets, you're expecting anywhere from 5 to 10% in terms of, annual cash flow, cash and cash return, right? Mm-hmm. The short-term rental, you can easily expect, if you're managing the property yourself, you can easily expect anywhere from 20 to 40%, depending on the market, right? And so when you introduce a property manager into the equation, what happens is that with long-term rentals, they typically charge around 10%, but with a short-term rental, a property manager, just because there's more in and out, more management involved, they charge anywhere from 25 to 30% of gross revenues, right? Annual gross revenue. So that can be a huge amount that you're paying a property manager. So what I typically recommend, and what a lot of investors in the short-term rental space at this point like to do, is at least that first year, they like to self-manage. So not have a property manager in there. And the advantages are twofold. A, you're not paying a property manager those high fees. The second thing is that if you're self-managing a property, then you're taking that short-term rental, which is in the passive bucket, basically, and moving it into your active income bucket, which is where you have all your clinical income, your earned income, your W-2 income, right? Mm-hmm. You put it in there. And then if you are able to bonus depreciate that property in that year, which is like accelerating depreciation, essentially, in year one, you're essentially able to pull out you're able to shelter your W-2 income from taxes and pull out all that money that you put in for your, hopefully as much as you put in for your down payment or even more, because you're using those strategies. So a lot of people prefer to not have property management in place, but self-manage by automating the process. Airbnb is a great platform. It lets you do it automatically. And then there are other softwares that you can use to integrate it across multiple platforms if you want to. But the whole goal with short-term rentals, even for people who are managing them out of state, is to have a system in place where you can get things done yourself without having a property manager in there. So you're boosting your cash flow, but you're also able to tap into those tax benefits that are afforded to you if you're actively managing it yourself. So, wow. Yeah, which is why it's like for someone who's starting out or someone who really wants to scale fast or and is willing to do that, it's a great strategy to just like take off, boost up, and help you rapidly grow your portfolio.
Yeah, sounds like it. I'm totally like impressed hearing how much difference it can make in terms of the cash flow and putting it in your active bucket. It's something totally different than long-term what I'm used to. So that's
yeah. And Austin's a great market for short-term rentals also.
Interesting.
It doesn't really cash flow for long-term rentals, but for short-term rentals, it apparently does well.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about market selections. What are the criteria for market selection for short-term rentals?
Yeah, and that's a great question because it's going to be very different from your long-term market, long-term rental market selection, right? So two important things. So when you talk about short-term rental markets, I think you can divide it essentially into metro markets because some people do it in cities, right? Like, so my short-term rental is in Bakersfield, which is a city. Some people do it in Atlanta, in Austin. So you could pick the metro market. You can have a short-term rental there. You can pick your typical vacation destinations, which again are classified into drive-to locations and fly-to locations, right? So the locations that people drive to are like the mountain locations in Tennessee, Blue Ridge, I'm totally blanking, the Smokies, right? Mm-hmm. And then the beach destinations in Florida along the Panhandle. Those are drive-to destinations. They tend to be more resilient because even if there's an economic downturn, people tend to just continue to vacation there. During the pandemic, those markets did have a little bit of a dip, but then they were able to recover rapidly and, you know, they had great occupancy. And then you have the fly-to locations like Orlando, Hawaii, where people like to fly to, but that during economic downturns, they can see more of a dip in terms of revenue. Mm-hmm. So it's important for you to think about that and also think about seasonality when you're picking your market. I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do it. As long as you know that it's aligned with your goals and if you whatever you feel makes the most sense for you at that point. Mm-hmm. So pick something and also look into seasonality. You don't want something where it's occupied during the summer months, but the rest of the time it really isn't making that much money. All of that needs to be factored into your underwriting or your calculator, whatever you're using upfront to make sure you're meeting those revenue goals that you set for yourself. And then the other important thing with short-term rentals, which is very different from long-term rentals, is looking at regulations, right? Local regulations keep changing constantly. So you really need to be on top of it. Even with areas that have been very vacation home friendly in the past, like Tahoe, they had regulation changes where they suddenly weren't really friendly to short-term rental investors. So you really want to know if they have established regulations in place and if they are favorable to investors. And you want to know if there's any upcoming change that may make things much harder for you, in terms of permits, transient occupancy taxes that need to be collected. You want to make sure you really understand all the regulations in place before you go into that market. So that's really important with short-term rentals.
Interesting. Would you recommend any resources available online for researching the market demand and knowing more about the regulations from the short-term rental perspective?
Yeah. So I always say when you're trying to pick a market, and this is what I recommend to everyone I mentor also, if there's a market that you go frequent, that you like going with your family and there could be dual purpose where you get personal use and you're able to use it as a short-term rental, then definitely try that first. Look into that market. AirDNA is a great source for data and it gives you two important numbers that you really need to know. You need to know what the occupancy is, the average occupancy over the course of the year. And you want to know what your average daily rate is, which is, there will be times when you'll be able to charge significantly higher, but you want to actually have an average so you can plug it into your calculator. So I have a separate short-term rental calculator on Generational Wealth MD's website. So that's generationalwealthmd.com. If you go to the resources section, there's a short-term rental calculator. You can grab those numbers from AirDNA, plug it into the calculator, and it will actually help you figure out what your revenue numbers are. It'll help you plug in all the other variables in there. So AirDNA is a great source. And then as far as regulations, there are multiple sites that will actually have regulations. But what I found the easiest is to pick your market, just Google to see if there are any ordinances. You can call the county clerk's office to see what the zoning regulations are and do your due diligence, because it may seem like overall a market is great, but then that sub-market or and your HOA may have separate regulations. So before you pick your specific market, just do your own due diligence, essentially.
Got it. That's a lot of information. Thank you so much. I'm learning so much myself. I truly appreciate you sharing all those golden nuggets there. Moving on. So in terms of like the time requirement, because you suggested going active is better, right? With the short-term rentals, the first mm-hmm. year at least. Mm-hmm. So what do you think are like the demands on time? How much time does it take for one property? Let's just take one number there.
Yeah. And then, so I always say this, right? With real estate in general, even with a long-term rental, even when you're doing the BRRRR strategy where you're rehabbing a property mm-hmm. and stuff, the amount of time you spend in year one is going to be very different from the time that you're going to spend going forward, right? So I don't want this to scare people because yes, initially, like the first month when you're getting a short-term rental, you're setting things up because you are going to be furnishing the place. You're going to be doing all of that, making it ready for your guests. You may be spending more time on the property. Let me start off on the back end. Once you have it set up and running, there are people in our community, multiple people who own multiple short-term rentals who don't spend more than 2 hours a week on their entire, self-managing those short-term okay. rentals, right? Okay. So that's the long-term goal. But when you are setting it up, you will be spending, I would say the first 4 to 6 weeks are probably going to be more hands-on where you're making sure everything's ready and you're going to get the property listed on Airbnb on those various platforms, have systems in place, so that it's all automated. You're having your teams, your handyman and your cleaners, all of that set up and have that system in place, essentially. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that if you are trying to get those, you know, make it an active investment, do it all by yourself without a property manager, and you're trying to get the hours to meet criteria for calling it an active business and then using those losses, then you have to meet one of seven criteria, but the easiest one for most people to meet is spending at least 100 hours on your property and more than anyone else. And I feel like when you're furnishing your property and you're doing all of that, you're easily able to meet those criteria. So although it may be more work than you want to, you are getting reimbursed for it essentially when you're able to take those tax savings and use it to shelter your clinical income and pay in some cases, even $100,000 less in taxes that year, right? So you get the money back. So it's like you're paid, rewarded for your effort, but the setup process can be depending on how you want to do it. Now, there are a lot of people who will purchase a short-term rental that was already running as a short-term rental and it's completely furnished. And at that point, the amount of time that you spend on it's going to be significantly less. So like anything in real estate, you can pick and choose what makes the most sense for you. If you're going into a short-term rental market and you're like, okay, I don't want to even think about furnishing this, find something that's already furnished, right? Find a property that's already running as a short-term rental. Setting it up, the process doesn't take that long. It depends on how many platforms you want it on initially. It's mm-hmm. always good to just have it on maybe Airbnb for the first few months till you get your feet wet and you're comfortable, and then just think about scaling if you want to. There's so many ways to do it where you could be spending anywhere from 100 hours in the first month on it to where you could only be spending like 5 or 6 hours on it every week in the first few weeks. And then ideally you should set it. So I say, if you are spending more than 2 hours a week on your short-term rental, you're doing something wrong and you need to optimize your systems essentially.
Got it. I have a few questions based on what you shared. Like the first being, you touched on being using the hours for being considered as a real estate professional, right?
You don't need to be a real estate professional. So for long-term rentals to use to actually use those strategies and shelter your W-2 income from taxes, you need to meet criteria for real estate professional status.
Right.
For a short-term rental, fortunately, the IRS considers it a business as long as you're meeting that 7 days or less per average stay per customer. Uh-huh. So it's already considered a business. So you just need to materially participate in it. So then your criteria is very different from reps. You don't have to meet real estate professional status, which is why everyone's going crazy about short-term.
Wow. Rentals. Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah. It is huge.
Because a lot of people with W-2s are not able to use that real estate professional status to shelter their income. And I think this is huge.
Yeah. For someone like you. So someone who wants to work full-time and still wants to do it and still wants to get some of the, still doesn't want to pay. Like I know a lot of physician families and high income, you know, people even in the Silicon Valley and stuff with high incomes. I know Texas is a great state to be in because you don't have state income tax, but there are a lot of people paying $200,000, $300,000 in just taxes mm-hmm. every year, right? And if you have a strategy to to pay significantly less in taxes, you can take that money and put it back into growing your portfolio, right?
Yeah, very cool, very cool. Let's talk a little bit about the system. So I understand, like, one is like setting up the security systems, right, putting it on Airbnb. What are the other backend systems that go into like establishing a short-term rental?
So Airbnb is constantly updating itself. And the good thing about that is that a lot of the dynamic pricing, sending out messages to your guests, like having a template that goes out automatically without you having to look into it, all of that is already being incorporated into Airbnb. So, and I say for starters, just try to use one platform and master it and get that set up. So that itself has a lot of those systems in. But the other things would be your boots on the ground, right? Because you don't want to be the person running around trying to get things done every time. So having a good cleaner comes with good references and a backup cleaner, and having a handyman and a backup handyman, and just having those systems in place essentially, so that if you have to have something done, you can easily tap into them and they help you take care of it rapidly. That's what you want to set up also.
Okay, got it. And then once you have one going, you can just use the same sources to scale for the other properties, which probably makes it easier.
Yes. And then, so there are pros and cons to that. With the long-term rentals, it's great to scale in the same market, right? Like you just build up because your system's in place. Now with short-term rentals, I think there's more of a, I like people to have a little bit of market diversification, just because with regulations and other things, you just don't know how regulation changes are going to affect your short-term rental. So having maybe two or three in one market is great, but I would say after that point may make sense to you're simultaneously growing your long-term rental portfolio also, which offers you some diversification, or you have market diversification if you're working essentially with short-term rentals, so that you're a little more protected in case there are any regulatory changes and stuff.
Got it. Very cool.
Well, that's just my take on it. I tend to be very conservative. And so I feel like it's always important to talk about risk mitigation also.
Yeah, especially because your investments are so high and you need to have like the protection of when things don't go as expected, right? So
yeah,
it's always
absolutely
good to approach that way. Finally, I want to understand in terms of like the numbers. So what are the numbers for I'm guessing it also depends on the markets, right? Short-term rental markets, where you are investing, it could be widely different. But on an average, if you have to compare the returns of cash on cash for short-term versus long-term, how do those numbers compare?
Yeah, so I would say, so always you're going to set the criteria, right? So if it doesn't make sense, you're not going to go into that market. But for an ideal market, if you're willing to accept 5% cash on cash for a long-term rental, I think for a short-term rental, you would want it to ideally be at least three times as much, right? Three or four times as much, because there's obviously, it's a little more on the active side compared to a long-term rental, right? With long-term rental, you have 3 to 5 year tenancies. You're really not even thinking about it. You just get money deposited. Yeah. So you want to set that for yourself to say, I want it to be at least 2 to 4 times more than what my long-term rental is giving me. And then it's also going to depend on your goals. If you are actively managing, you're self-managing, then you're going to set that cash and cash based on that. So most people in my membership program who are doing short-term rentals want to get at least 30% cash on cash return for a property they're self-managing. Mm-hmm. Because if they were ever to put a property manager in there, it's going to be at least 20% minimum, right? In terms of how much they're going to charge. So you want to have that buffer so that if you were ever to be able to put a property manager in there, you're still not going to be negative on your property. You don't want that. Mm-hmm. So I say, and with some markets, I think with most markets, you can easily do 20 to 40% depending on the property and the number of bedrooms and stuff. But if you're self-managing, then I say always leave a little buffer in there in case you ever need to put a property manager in place.
Got it.
Okay. And you want to make it worth your effort. So it has to be significantly higher than a long-term rental.
Right. Makes sense. Okay. I want to understand a little bit more on, or at least for me, I felt like the trend for short-term rentals has been pretty recent, new. Do you think that came on because of the pandemic, or was it always there in the backdrop and it's just more people are now learning about it?
So it's always been there, Manasa. So people have been doing it for many, many years. And in some markets, it's like well-established, but they were doing it very differently. If you look at the, say, the Blue Ridge area, right? So they have a group of people, property managers. And so before, it was really hard to self-manage because we didn't have the technology that we now have to be able to self-manage remotely, right? Mm-hmm. So you needed to have a property manager who was present locally, who would let people in, give them a key, talk to them, and just greet them at the door, right? That was essential almost before, right? Mm-hmm. They say even 5 years ago. But now technology has evolved so much that it's become possible for people to self-manage, to list it on these platforms, which weren't used as widely before. I'd say that especially with the pandemic, more and more people have taken to using Airbnb and VRBO, right? Mm-hmm. So the awareness and the exposure has increased. But before that, vacation rentals were always rented very differently. They were rented on a website by these people. Property managers have been doing it for years and years. So it was a very different model. Mm-hmm. With the current model, it makes it very easy for an investor to consider self-managing, even if it's remote, because most of us live in cities and the short-term rentals are going to be like 2 or 3 hours away. And it's possible for you to do it now without having to go there and be there for every guest who enters, right? Unless it's mandated. Some places mm-hmm. still mandate that you have a co-host who is local, mm-hmm. who's there to greet your guests when they come in. But it's not necessary, which is why it's opened it. So it's like opening the box and opening opportunities, right? So it's technology, it's more people using Airbnb and all of those platforms. And there's definitely been a shift in the way people travel because of the pandemic. We can't mm-hmm. ignore that. But the talk always is, what happens when things change? So there are two things. A, the way people travel has changed. And it's like Zoom. We're using Zoom right now. Yeah. It was in April. People were like, bye. You know, I'm using Zoom to do this thing. I'm like, what is Zoom? Right. So, but we're never going to go back. I mean, we may have a different, we may have different systems, but this is going to be part of our lives. And right. I think the way people travel has also changed. So it's hard for that to go back. I mean, I've traveled since the pandemic. Oh my God. I've like traveled to so many places in California, which are like a couple of hours from where we live. And we do so many day trips. And I uh-huh. had not thought about exploring that before the pandemic, right? Because you would just fly somewhere. It was right. just natural. Mm-hmm. So travel patterns have shifted drastically. And then more and more people are using Airbnb and VRBO. That is not going to change. So although there may be slightly higher bump right now in revenues because of the pandemic, uh-huh. it's not going to go back to its old baseline. But I think all of those shifts and transitions are what has exposed more people to short-term rentals at this point.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you. That's very, very informative. Yeah. Just a few more questions there. So the short-term rental market, is that people are preferring it for vacation mode where they would choose to stay in an Airbnb, a house versus like a hotel? Is the preference coming from there, or is it more because like, oh, they just have to like visit a place and they don't feel comfortable in the hotel, like for, you know, just for like scouting for houses in a very busy market, because now finding houses also has become difficult. So where is the exact demand coming from? Is it more from a vacation perspective for short-term rentals?
So I think it's a combination of both, right? So I think initially more people were using it because that's what constituted a big shift. They weren't comfortable using hotels uh-huh. and they wanted a space that felt safer where they could have family gatherings, uh-huh. which is why, like, if you talk to people in the space, they're finding that they definitely have more occupancy with short-term rentals that have 4 bedrooms or more. And that's because uh-huh. that's how people get together now. It's not just like one family traveling. It's like multiple families getting together because it's just hard. It's been harder for them to get together any other way. Right. So, then it becomes cheaper. It's also, once they start doing that, once they start the shift was because people wanted to stay away from hotels. They felt safer in Airbnbs. But with that shift also came the realization that it was probably also cheaper and it was more economic because now you have like a kitchen and you can save on other costs. And then you're actually opening yourself up to that possibility can be hard for people, right? Going and staying in someone else's home and you're like, is this safe and all of that. But once you get used to it, you realize the unique advantages that offers, right? And the unique places that you can go stay in. So all the log cabins and the mountains and the views, I mean, that's not something you wouldn't get that feeling if you stayed in a hotel. Right. So the shift, the pandemic was a big part of that shift for people to actually open themselves up to it. But once they start using it, they realize how simple and easy it is and they probably feel safer doing it. So people are using it for multiple reasons. I know that some of our members who have short-term rentals are even doing midterm rentals where people like to go because they have the ability of working from home. Now they can go pick a place, stay there for a few months, want and really just like, you know, soak in the experience. And so it's a combination of different things, but I think the pandemic really helped with that mindset shift. Like we wouldn't be using Zoom this frequently if it hadn't been for the pandemic, even though it was available, right? Same thing. So now people are more open to it because of the pandemic, but it's for vacationing, it's for short stays, just because they can now work from home and they can do that in a place that has Wi-Fi and it doesn't have to be home.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah. Good to know. So on that note, my last question there, I don't want to like really just spend all our time in this one topic, but if you had like an X amount, if an investor had an X amount, how would they approach trying to figure out investing in long-term rental versus short-term rental? I know cash on cash is like a really good indicator, but what other aspects should be taken into consideration for that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Manasa. And I get this all the time because well, like the last cohort that I just started in fall, greater than 60% of them have got a short-term rental. Now that's because it's calendar year based and they wanted to get it. And as long as they place it in service before the end of December, a lot of them are getting $50,000, $100,000 saved in taxes this year, right? So everyone's doing that. But my goal for them over time is to help build their long-term portfolios also simultaneously because I want it to be diversified. So the questions you need to be asking yourself for anyone starting out is, the premise of this is that there's slightly more risk involved in short-term rentals because at the end of the day, it is a business, right? It's not residential like long-term rentals are. So it is a business. There will be regulatory changes. And so you need to factor all of that in. But that being said, if you're doing your due diligence, then you're obviously picking something where you're going to have continued great appreciation and great revenues coming in, right? So it will depend on what stage you are in terms of your portfolio, right? So for someone starting out and who's working full-time, I still think short-term rentals are a great way for you to put your money in and then self-manage at least year one and then pull that money out come tax time and take the money. And then it's like infinite returns, right? You pull out all your initial investment, you put it into something else and you keep growing your portfolio. So for someone starting out, I think it has great value. For someone who wants to scale rapidly, I think there's great value as long as you're also diversifying your portfolio. I don't know if you've heard of Avery and Carl, Avery Luke, the short-term shop, they own that and they manage and they have multiple short-term rentals of their own, but they're also simultaneously building, they're taking a lot of that revenue and building their long-term rental portfolio. So I think it's really important to have that balance. But for someone starting out, someone looking to scale rapidly, I think it's great to have that in your portfolio. It's like like a workhorse that's churning money faster. And then also for someone who's a seasoned investor who's getting closer to the point where they want to retire on that portfolio, based on that portfolio, I think there's a place for it. For them, I would say you want it to be more skewed towards long-term because that's a more, that's less risky thing to have in your portfolio. But having a little exposure to short-term rentals, I think is always great. Yeah. And for someone like that, I would say something that you can use also, because then at that point, it's more about lifestyle for them, right? Mm-hmm. Than the revenue. So something that you could also use personally would be great. And then that's another way to tap into the increased revenue that you get from it. Because, and yeah, so it's going to be very different depending on whether you're starting out, how much cash you have, because with short-term rentals, you're able to go in with the 10% down, how many years to financial freedom, and then, you know, what your current portfolio looks like. So it would almost be like strategy, right? Looking at everything that's in there and also your income, right? If it's a two member, two spouse, two full-time working individuals in the family, you have more cash reserves. You have the ability to take on a little more risk and stuff. So all of those things would come into play. So I feel like it's very important to have personalized strategy and have a mentor can really help with that so that you're doing things the safe way. But I find that for most people, there is a place for short-term rentals in some way. You know, some of our members house hack, they do house hack Airbnbs, right? Uh-huh. So they use a part of their home. Some of them have their vacation homes that they're doing it in. Some of them have short-term rentals in metro markets where their exit strategy is, you know, if something changes, they could easily convert that to a long-term rental. And we always run numbers to make sure that works also. There's so many different ways to do it. And so depending on where you are, you can pick the one that makes the most sense to you.
Really, really cool. Those are some golden nuggets. So that note, touch a little bit about your coaching program so that folks know if they want to learn more, how they can reach out to you and how exactly is it structured.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I got to the point where I hit financial independence, I was able to scale back. I just saw so many of my friends still doing like crazy commutes, right? Like 3 hours a day commuting. And then one of my friends was, she would travel out of town like 3 weeks in a month just to work a job, and only spend like a week, a month with her kids. And it was crazy. So I started coaching people. I started off with this WhatsApp group where, you know, I had people, and then I realized that I could do Q&As and webinars, but for them to actually take steps and actually have a transformation to be able to actually have the massive action that I thought they could do it, there needed to be more structured learning, which is why I created the program. It's called Creating Generational Freedom. And it's an 8-week, it's an immersive small group coaching program. I also offer one-on-one coaching, and we go over everything related to real estate. So initially it's about learning, you know, the first part is really understanding what your strategy should be based on where you are, and then picking your market and forming your teams on the ground, learning to run numbers and how to, because the biggest thing for most people is, I don't think I have the time or the money to do it. And there's so many, you know, in real estate, there's so much option for creative financing. So we talk about creative financing. We talk about building systems so that you're really not spending, you shouldn't be spending more than 2 hours a week on your portfolio if you don't want to. And if you don't, then, you know, we help structure that, talk about tax strategies, accounting, because that's big, right? That's where you lose a lot of your money if you're not set up to have those systems in place, asset protection. And we talk about short-term rentals, rehab, so all of that. And it's like this community where we do, there are the educational modules, which obviously help, but then we also have group sessions weekly. And then we have a membership community afterwards for ongoing support. And the goal is to get everyone to get at least their first property while they're, you know, within the first 8 weeks of the program. But most people are already working on their second and third property by the time the program's done. So yeah, so the goal is to give you that personalized strategy and the ongoing support that you need so you can scale and do. And then people always say, so what is a realistic goal for 12 months? And I say, whatever you want it to be. Because I used to say, oh yeah, you can get 3 properties. So that's not true, because it's whatever you want to be. And I'm just seeing that, you know, when people set their mind to it, I have someone who joined 2 weeks ago and he's looking at a 16 unit, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be 2 doors in the first year. It could be whatever you want it to be, whatever is aligned with your goals. And then we work and help you through that.
Got it. Very, very cool. That's good to know. And thank you for sharing again. Finally, my last question for the show, which I ask all my guests, is we touched a lot about financial freedom, but I want to know from your perspective, what is financial freedom? And my show also has Be Your Own Boss. And you are your own boss. You have so much going on, entrepreneurship, you have the coaching program, you have the real estate stuff. So what does financial freedom and Be Your Own Boss mean to you?
Yeah. And I think for most of us, financial freedom for me means time freedom, right? And location freedom, because I have my family back home in India and I want to be able to move and travel whenever I want to. You know, my dad was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago and I was only able to spend 4 weeks with him and get him through the surgery. I wasn't there for chemo. And all of that really affected me because I wanted to have that freedom, the freedom to do, to be where I want to be and have the time to do it and be able to shift locations. That's important to me. So for me, it's about location and time freedom. Just being there for my family and spending time with my kids now when they really want to be around me, because I know it's going to change over time. So for me, that's absolute freedom. And I also, it's also associated to generational freedom, right? And I talk about that because whatever I learn now, those skills are going to pass on to my kids. And I want them to have the same freedom. And transferring that wealth of knowledge is also important to me. So yeah.
Got it. Thank you so much for sharing all that and being my guest today. I love your energy and you've shared so much valuable information today. I truly appreciate it. Is there anything else that you want to leave my listeners with today?
Sure. So first of all, likewise, I love your energy too, Manas. I love what you're doing. I think it's just amazing. But for your listeners, I always feel like an important thing to focus on is our why, right? Like when you talk about financial freedom, like, so that's why, that's what we're focusing on when we're doing all this, right? There will be times when it can be overwhelming or you feel like, oh my God, it's too uncomfortable. And then the why is going to get you through. So think about your why, think about why you want to do this and what your end goal is. And if it's like, you know, I want to do this because I want more time with my family, or I want to pursue my passion, or I want to make a career shift, whatever it is, focus on that why. And that's what's going to get you through. And I always say knowing your financial independence numbers really helps you, because if you don't know where you are, you think you may be going on the right path, but you don't have clarity about how long it's going to take you to get there, which is what my thing was, right? The minute I realized it was going to take me 15 years doing what I was doing, I was like, I have to do something different. So I have a financial independence worksheet on the website. So if you go to the resources section again of generationalwealthmd.com, there is a financial independence worksheet. It helps you plug your numbers in so you know exactly where your financial independence numbers are and how long it's going to take you to get to financial freedom. So I encourage you to just do it. I think exercise itself is the motivation that most of us need to make a shift. So I would encourage everyone listening to at least take one little step. I think that's a tiny step, but it has a huge impact.
So true. So true. So folks, do go and check out her website. It's Generational Wealth MD that has a lot of free resources where you can actually look at numbers rather than just thinking of ideas in your mind. And that makes a lot of difference once you put the pen to the paper and look at real numbers to come up with a plan as a next step. Well, thank you again. I'll have that on my show notes for folks to go check it out. And if you love this episode, folks, please do leave me a review and let me know what your favorite part on the whole show was. So until next time, stay safe and we will be back soon.
You've been listening to The Real Path to BYOB. Be your own boss. The 9 to 5, busting your hump for someone else, barely scraping by. With this show, that ends. We hope you've gotten some useful and practical information from this show, and we hope we've helped inspire and give you strategies to maximize your passive wealth through real estate. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, hook up with us on Instagram at Silicon Hills Capital Group and sign up on our webpage at siliconhillscapitalgroup.com to be notified about upcoming webinars and get a copy of the monthly newsletter. You're on track with The Real Path to BYOB. Be your own boss.